brethren, if you would turn back with me to 2 Timothy chapter 4, I'd like to begin the message here by reading the first couple of verses in 2 Timothy chapter 4. Second Timothy 4, beginning in verse 1, Paul writing to Timothy, young minister, giving him instruction, encouragement, admonition here on what he should be doing in his role. We read here in verse 1, I charge you, therefore, before God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who will judge the living and the dead at his appearing and his kingdom. Preach the word. Be ready in season and out of season. Convince, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and teaching. So Paul admonishes Timothy here to preach the word, to be ready to do so in season and out of season. As you know, and we've talked about before, there are certain seasons of the year where certain topics just make sense, and we should be prepared to talk about them, especially someone who's assigned the task of speaking to the congregation once a week. But there are also times when we need to be ready out of season as well. Other times during the year too. It's not as if we only need to be aware and able to teach about certain topics only certain times of the year, but there is that natural cycle, season, so to speak, of certain topics. What season are we in now? Well, as you know, we're getting very close to a very special season of the year, the beginning of the fall holy days. A season of hope. A season that is exciting to think about, to meditate on the reality of what is to come in the future when Jesus Christ returns and intervenes for humanity. But we're not quite in that season yet. A week from this Monday, we'll be keeping the Feast of Trumpets. We'll begin that season of hope. What season are we in now? As we think about anticipating and celebrating the cycle of God's annual festivals once again, the fall holy days, consider what time are we in now, leading up to those holy days? Well, prophetically, in terms of the fulfillment of the fall festivals of God, what will this time be like? What will the time leading up to the fulfillment of the Feast of Trumpets be like? The answer is not pretty. The simple, straightforward answer is that it will be a time of trouble, of tribulation, of persecution, of destruction. Not fun things to talk about. And yet, we just read in 2 Timothy 4 that we need to preach the word in season and out of season, to convince, to rebuke, to exhort, for the purpose of encouraging all of us to press on. Because yes, troubling, difficult times are coming, but the fulfillment of all of our hopes comes afterward. What will the time leading up to the fulfillment of the Feast of Trumpets be like? Let's go back to Matthew chapter 24. Even though this is not a fun topic to consider, probably not our favorite passages of scripture to ponder, this is a question that is timely, it is in season, and something we need to think about and be reminded of. A similar question was asked here in Matthew chapter 24, beginning in verse 3. Matthew 24, verse 3. Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? What will it be like before you return? What will it be like before you set up the kingdom of God on the earth? And Christ begins to answer here in verse 4. Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. In our modern vernacular, we might paraphrase verse 8 and say, and you ain't seen nothing yet. In response to this question from his disciples, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? What will this time be like before you set up the kingdom of God on the earth? Christ gave some answers here. And we can see connections with these descriptions and the world seen around us today. Many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. Not just claiming to be Christ, but what we're really reading here is a description of false Christianity. Many claiming to represent Christ. Many claiming to say, this is what Jesus Christ is like. This is what it looks like to follow him. How many different forms of Christianity are there in the world today? I remember, after I returned from Camp Heritage, one of the questions that was submitted by a team there during our Q&A was, how are we supposed to respond when someone asks, what type of Christian are you? Well, how many answers should there be? Should that even need to be a question? If a Christian is a disciple of Christ, a follower of Jesus Christ, you shouldn't have to delineate what kind a follower of Christ you are. Yet, we see around us in the world today the fulfillment of verse 5. Many who come in his name claim to represent him. False Christianity. And you'll hear of wars and rumors of wars. You heard about any wars lately? Of course, the one that gets the most attention right now is the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Sad stories coming out of there. I was reading just the other day about the story of a medic who was basically held captive in Mariupol, and she was conveying what she experienced, what she witnessed in that town. But you know, this Russia-Ukraine war that started relatively recently, just back in February, when things really heated up again, that's just one of many. Did a little search a couple days ago. How many active wars are there in the world right now? And the answer that I found was, well, it depends on how you define war. You're talking about more than 10,000 lives lost within the past year, then there are 6 active wars in which more than 10,000 people have died in the last year. If you take that number down to between 1,000 and 999 deaths in the last year, there are 17 others. If you take it down from there, I'm sorry, that was between 1,000 and 9,999. If you take it down from there, there are 19 other active conflicts. More than 10,000, between 1,000 and 10,000, between 100 and 1,000 in the last year, are over 40. And then Christ talked about rumors of wars here. How many rumors of wars are there going on in the world right now? Speculation about China preparing to invade Taiwan, and speculation about China and Russia working together on some joint military operations or simulations. Rumors of wars, just like Christ predicted 2,000 years ago. See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. We're hearing more and more in the news lately about the potential for famine. You know that famine affects different parts of the world already. It's not as if it hasn't been taking place. But we hear more and more stories, again connected with, especially the war in Ukraine, about how food shortages have become a very real, significant trial for humanity in the near future. I don't have the percentages or the statistics with me, but I was blown away in talking with someone recently, and then looking it up myself as well, at the percentage of wheat production that comes out of Ukraine. Not just providing food wheat bread for their own country, but the amount that they produce and sell to other nations. There's no such thing as an isolated conflict anymore in our world. But the way nations are interconnected, you can see how war naturally leads to famine and then pestilences. Heard anything about that in the last 3 years? Disease epidemics. Earthquakes in various places. Natural disasters. Unlike any other time in human history. Yet Christ says, all these are the beginning of sorrows. What will this time be like leading up to the return of Christ? Sorrowful. Let's go back to Revelation chapter 6. Because we have a passage here that correlates with what Jesus Christ was describing in Matthew 24. If you compare Matthew 24 and Revelation chapter 6, the various prophetic seals that are described here in Revelation chapter 6, you'll see a direct correlation, which makes sense because it's the same divine being speaking in both passages. Christ speaking to his disciples in the Olivet prophecy in Matthew 24, Luke 21, Mark 13, and Jesus Christ revealing these things to the Apostle John in the book of Revelation. But before we look at these seals in Revelation chapter 6, I want to go back to Revelation chapter 5. I think it's important to read chapter 5 here before we dive into chapter 6. Revelation chapter 5, this heavenly scene is being described. 24 elders and 4 living creatures around the throne of God. And we'll pick it up in chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. And I saw on the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll written inside and on the back, sealed with 7 seals. Then I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and to loose its seals?" And no one in heaven or on the earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look at it. So I wept much because no one was found worthy to open and read the scroll or to look at it. But one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has prevailed to open the scroll and to loose its 7 seals." And I looked, and behold, in the midst of the throne and of the 4 living creatures, and in the midst of the elders stood a lamb as though it had been slain, having 7 horns and 7 eyes, which are the 7 spirits of God sent out into all the earth. Then he came and took the scroll out of the right hand of him who sat on the throne. Now when he had taken the scroll, the 4 living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp, and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, saying, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals. For you were slain, and have redeemed them to God by your blood, out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and have made them kings and priests to their God, and they shall reign on the earth." You probably noticed I changed some of these pronouns from us to them, we to they. The footnote in my Bible, perhaps in your Bible too, if you have a study Bible, that is a possible translation, a difference between some manuscripts. It makes sense that these heavenly beings, these 24 elders, these 4 living creatures, wouldn't be talking about Jesus Christ being slain for them, but rather they're singing this song about us. Now, why read this before going into chapter 6 and the description of these 7 seals? Because I think it's important, brethren, for us to keep in context who it is that was worthy to open the scroll. Throughout the book of Revelation, the main thread or theme through this book is seals, trumpets, and plagues, this outline of what's to come in the time of the end. 7 seals, 7 trumpets, 7 plagues. And these are troublesome things to read about. Not fun things to study and to think about coming to pass in reality on the earth where people we love live. But it's important to keep in context who opens the scroll, who loosens these seals. It's the one who is slain to redeem us by his blood. The one who has in mind for us to reign with him as kings and priests. So whatever we're about to read that's revealed in these seven seals, these prophetic seals, and what will happen when they're opened, we have to keep in context the fact that it's the one who loved us enough to die for us and wants us to reign with him on the earth who's revealing these things. So as troublesome as they may be, we have to keep it in that proper context of the love of God, knowing that he's going to see us through whatever we have to endure. In chapter 6 then, picking it up in verse 1, we have these seven seals that are beginning to be described here. The first four are often referred to as the four horsemen of the apocalypse, a human name that's been given to them. In verse 1, now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a voice like thunder, come and see. And I looked, and behold, a white horse. He who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. Some people read that description and they come to the false conclusion that this is a prophecy about the gospel being preached. You know, who comes riding on a white horse? Jesus Christ. But if you compare this passage to what we read in Matthew 24, where Christ said, many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ. This white horse and the one riding on it is not a representative of Jesus Christ. This is false Christianity. When Christ comes, he comes on a white horse with a sword in his mouth and fire in his eyes, not with a bow, as we see described here. This is a counterfeit. In verse 3, when he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, come and see. Another horse, fiery red, went out. And it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another. And there was given to him a great sword. Compare that to Matthew 24. And there shall be wars and rumors of war. And in verse 5, then he opened the third seal, and I heard the third living creature say, come and see. So I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine. Mr. Lutz gave a message recently in Wheeling. I know he gave it here in Pittsburgh a while back too, about God's ability to use weather to bring about punishment on mankind. And he read this passage. He talked about the description here being of famine, which often comes from drought. Well, what did we read in Matthew 24? Wars, rumors of wars, famine. A quart of wheat for a denarius, a day's wages to be able to pay for just enough to make a loaf of bread. Continuing in verse 7, when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, come and see. So I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed with him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth. This pale, sickly-looking horse, representing death, it says here. If you compare it to Matthew 24, we read about false Christ, wars, rumors of wars, famine, and pestilence, disease, sickness. We see this correlation between the two passages. Now, the teaching of the Church of God is that these seals, once opened, remain open. What we're reading here is not just a neat and orderly timeline of events that we can look at and say, okay, well, first, false Christianity. Okay, that's done. Now let's move on to war. And once war is finished, then we'll have some famine. No. Once one seal is opened, it stays open, and it intensifies with time. And the other seals being opened only amplify, magnify the impacts of the previous seal. False Christianity isn't going to just stop. between now and the return of Jesus Christ. It's not going to be finished. That seal is opened, and it will stay open. When you think about a seal and what it is, our modern day equivalent would be an envelope being closed. Once you open it up, you can't get it shut back. At least not in the same way that it was. You might try with a little bit of clear tape or a little bit of glue under there. But once it's open, it's open. And the same with these seals on this scroll. We might picture this scroll that Jesus Christ was worthy to open, to loose these seals on. And we might picture these seven seals revealing a section of that scroll, one section at a time. When that first seal is broken and released, the scroll opens a little bit. You can see what's about to happen. When that second seal breaks loose, it opens even more. But once it's unrolled, it's open. These things continue down through time. So it has been the teaching of the Church of God that these first four seals, these beginning of sorrows, as Christ described in Matthew 24, have already begun. We already see false Christianity at work. We already see wars and rumors of wars and famines and pestilences. Those things have been happening for centuries. And they'll continue to happen and only get worse and more intense. I think it's important to note here in verse 8, though, a specific that I can't say has been fulfilled yet at this point. It says, power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beast of the earth. Has a fourth of the earth been destroyed by this seal? I don't know. Maybe there's still a fulfillment of this one yet to come, and it's more intense, surprise states. It's also interesting here that, you know, the correlating passage in Matthew 24 talks about pestilence, but then this description here is powers given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth. We see some connections with the previous seals. The sword, war, hunger, famine, death could specifically be related to death by disease. Then I find that last phrase interesting, and by the beasts of the earth. And there was a specific prophecy back in Deuteronomy 28, the blessings and cursings chapter, that talked about, or maybe been in Leviticus 26, one of those sections talks about beasts of the earth, basically wild animals coming in and destroying the people, consuming their children. Heard from time to time that that is also a product of war and of famine, as there's destruction in a land, and there's not the normal agriculture around for even the animals to eat. They come into different areas where they once had an inhabitant. That's definitely a possible fulfillment of this verse. I heard an interesting speculation. I'd like to highlight the word speculation. I'm going to say it three more times just in case you didn't hear it. Speculation! Speculation, speculation. In the midst of this description of death, pestilence, disease, this sickly-looking horse, we have that phrase, and by the beast of the earth. Where have many of the recent diseases, epidemics, pandemics, been traced back to? Think about some of the names of them. Bird flu, swine flu, monkeypox, coronavirus. Could it be that a fulfillment of this verse here in Revelation 6, verse 8, is death that comes by beasts of the earth, not necessarily by them coming and chewing on your leg, but perhaps some disease or sickness that comes as its source coming from these beasts of the earth. I don't know, just speculation, interesting thing to think about. But what can we expect next? If these seals are open and have been open for centuries, what can we expect to happen going forward from here? What else will this time be like leading up to the return of Jesus Christ? Not pretty. Keep reading verse 9. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Then a white robe was given to each of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer, until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren, who would be killed as they were, was completed. This fifth seal, the next one to be opened, as we understand it, is about religious persecution, tribulation, which even includes the death of some for faithfully serving God. Not fun things to talk about. And we need to mention here, having just read these verses, what's actually happening here? Did we just read a description of proof of the immortal soul? It says here that there are souls crying out under the altar in the third heaven, crying out, asking God to avenge them. How much longer do we have to wait? Well, we need to understand that the book of Revelation is full of symbolic language, as well as descriptions of literal events, literal things. We have to be able to use discernment, and we have to use the entirety of God's word to determine what is to be taken literally and what is figurative. We know several other verses that tell us this can't be literal. If the soul that sins shall die, there is no thought in the grave, etc., etc. What we're reading here isn't proof that there are immortal souls in heaven begging God to hurry up the process. What we read here is a figurative statement, similar to what we read back in the story of Cain and Abel. When Cain killed Abel and God said to Cain, the voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Was that literal? Ah! I'm Abel's blood! It was Cain! He did it! It's not supposed to be taken literally. God was using figurative language to basically say, I know what has happened. I know what took place, Cain. Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. It doesn't escape my sight. That's exactly the kind of thing we read here in this fifth seal. God knows those who have suffered for his name, those who have even been put to death for his name, for believing in him. And he has plans to bring an end to that time. But he says in verse 11, rest a little while longer until the number of your fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed as they were was completed. What will this time be like leading up to the return of Jesus Christ? There will be religious persecution. There will even be martyrdom that affects the people of God. Not pretty, but we have to be honest about what the Bible tells us is to come. Keeping it all in the context of the fact that the one who opened these seals to reveal these truths is the one who died for us and wants us to reign with him. He knows exactly what we can handle, what he'll allow us to go through, and what he can use to strengthen us and to build our character in the most effective way possible. We could keep reading here in the sixth seal, these heavenly signs that happened just before the return of Christ. Let's go back to Matthew 24 instead. I said that these passages correlate with one another. We just read this description of the fifth seal. Let's see if we find anything here in Matthew 24 that's related. Matthew 24, we'll go back to verse 9. Matthew 24, verse 9, after saying, these are the beginning of sorrows, Christ continues, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. This is temporary. Yes, terrible things are coming. Yes, trials are coming, tribulation, persecution, even the death of some of the faithful. But it's a temporary period of time that will usher in an endless season of the reign of Jesus Christ. Now, Christ was speaking to his disciples here in response to their question, what will this time be like? He's talking about the time of the end of the age, what we can expect then. And he says, you will be delivered up to tribulation. Tribulation and religious persecution, associated here with offense and betrayal and deception, love growing cold. The word tribulation here is translated from the Greek word klipsis, which means oppressing, or pressing together, or pressure. We talked about that related to the camp theme this year. Courage under fire, under pressure. What will this time be like? It'll be a time of pressure, of oppression, of affliction, of tribulation. The oppression of God's people has ebbed and flowed for centuries following Jesus Christ's death. In a sense, we might wonder, has this seal already been opened too? Because some have suffered for their beliefs in the past, for sure. Even some of the apostles were put to death because of what they believed. But Christ is giving us a description of what will happen in the end time. This is something that will yet happen in the future. If that seal is opened, in a sense, it remains open. However, we continue reading here in Matthew chapter 24, and we see that there's a connection here with this description of the fifth seal in Revelation 6, this tribulation and trouble that comes on specifically the people of God. There's a connection here between a much more widespread tribulation that will affect more than just God's people. Continue in verse 15. Matthew 24, verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time. No, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. That's our teaching in the Church of God, that this time of religious persecution that we read about, tribulation toward the saints, that this time coincides with the great tribulation that Jesus Christ describes here that will affect the entire world. This fifth seal, this tribulation on the people of God, coincides with the great tribulation that will affect all of mankind. It involves pressure, persecution, trouble. Just as a side note here, I think verse 22 is a additional proof, definitely not the most solid proof, but an additional proof of the fact that there is no such thing as a rapture before the coming of Christ. Because it says here, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. If we were all floating up in heaven, already changed to spirit beings at this time, why would the time need to be shortened for our sake? Right? This time of great tribulation. So let's recap what we've covered so far. What will this time leading up to the fulfillment of the Feast of Trumpets be like? It will be a time of great tribulation for all the world. Tribulation such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. But it's also a time of tribulation for the people of God. It'll affect the entire world, as we read, because unless those days were shortened, there wouldn't be any people left. But we also read here in verse 15 about a time marker. Something that we should be watching for that will tell us the fact that things are about to heat up. In verse 15, Christ said, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, then don't go try to pack your bags. Don't go back for something you forgot. Get out of Dodge." He doesn't tell us what that means, what his faithful people are supposed to do, where they're supposed to go. That's not for us to try to figure out. God will reveal to us what we need to know when we need to know it. But we have this time marker here. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, let's go back to the book of Daniel and see what he spoke about it. Daniel chapter 12. Daniel chapter 12, we'll begin in verse 1. Daniel 11 is such an incredible chapter that covers a huge portion of human history. The rise and fall of different rulers and empires, concluding with a description in the last several verses about the king of the north and the king of the south that will come on the scene at the time of the end. And in that context, we begin chapter 12, verse 1. It says, "At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time." The same description that Jesus Christ gave in Matthew 24 about this time of great tribulation. "And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever." Again, we're given these encouraging verses filled with hope in the context of these troublesome times. Yes, times of trial and tribulation are coming, but at that time, your people will be delivered. And we have this description of the resurrection of the dead. Verse 4, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two others, one on this riverbank and the other on that riverbank. And one said to the man clothed in linen, who is above the waters of the river, 'How long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be?' Then I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven, and swore by him who lives forever, that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the people is as strong as ever..." No. Not what we read there. "And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. Although I heard, I did not understand. Then I said, 'My Lord, what shall be the end of these things?' And he said, 'Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified, made white, and refined. But the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand. But the wise shall understand.'" God will give us the understanding we need the time we need it. "And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. But you go your way till the end, for you shall rest and will arise to your inheritance at the end of the days." But when Christ said, when you see the abomination of desolation, which Daniel the prophet spoke of, we just read in verse 11, when Daniel spoke of it here. "From the time of the daily sacrifice is taken away, and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. We have this interesting difference in numbers here in chapter 12. In verse 7, we read about a time, times, and half a time. We believe that a time represents a year. So a time, times, 2 years, and half a time, a period of 3.5 years. In other sections of scripture, we have descriptions of this time of the end being 1260 days. But then in verse 11, when it talks about from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, the abomination is set up, we have 1290 days. And blessed is he who makes it to 1335 days. Mr. Wilkes will explain the difference between all those. Once again, that goes on my list of simply, I don't know. There have been different ideas presented about that. Now, the difference between 1260 days and 1290. Christ in Matthew 24 tells us, when you see this, flee. So could it be we have a period of 30 days there to get wherever we need to be before this intense persecution begins? I don't know. Others say, well, what's the conclusion of all these end time events? It's the return of Jesus Christ. So maybe the 1260 days, the 1290 days, the 1335 days, maybe they all end at the same time at the return of Jesus Christ, but different things happen at different times prior to that. We just don't know. And I think that's the way God designed it on purpose. Because if we ever get to a point where we feel like, well, this hasn't happened yet, so I know I have plenty of time left. Well, I know I still have 3.5 years left because I haven't seen the abomination of desolation yet. Well, I know I have this many days left because this hasn't happened and these boxes haven't been checked. That is not the approach that Christ wants us to take. That was not the point of giving this description to his disciples. Not so that we feel like we still have time. The complete opposite was his intention. To create an urgency within us, to make sure we're ready regardless of the time that Jesus Christ returns. To make sure that we have an urgency in pursuing our relationship with God so that if he counts us worthy to escape these things, we can. But this description of the abomination of desolation, this is obviously a prophecy about the future, because Jesus Christ said it's something that would happen, that would tell the people of God that his coming is soon, it's going to happen at the end of the age. But it's also something that's happened already in the past. So we can look at the historical fulfillments of the abomination of desolation to kind of glean some insights into what might take place that will fulfill that prophecy. Let's go back to chapter 8 here in the book of Daniel. Daniel 8, beginning in verse 9. One of the challenges with preparing this message is that there's so much going on behind the scenes prophetically, and I have to resist the urge to always explain the context of what we're about to read, because that would take way too much time. So we're about to read about this little horn. You have a copy of the Bible just like me, and you have lots of resources on Life, Hope, and Truth website. If you need a refresher on who and what this little horn is, I'll encourage you to do that. We'll pick it up here in Daniel 8, verse 9. And out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the hosts and some of the stars to ground and sampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the hosts, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. Over in Daniel chapter 11 as well, we have a description of this same event, this same little horn. In the middle of this incredible chapter that I mentioned before, Daniel 11, which covers an incredible period of human history. Well, in Daniel 11, let's read verse 31, describing this same leader that was the fulfillment of this prophecy of this little horn. Daniel 11, verse 31, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. I'd like to read you a short excerpt from our Life, Hope, and Truth article titled, What is the Abomination of Desolation? It says, quote, Antiochus Epiphanes, or according to Mr. Johnson, Antiochus Epiphanes. We'll go with the first one. Antiochus Epiphanes was hostile to Jewish worship and attempted to Hellenize or enforce the adoption of Greek culture and religion on the Jews in Judea. He outlawed all forms of Jewish worship and placed a Hellenized high priest over the temple who was sympathetic to his rule. He eventually outlawed practices like circumcision, the biblical dietary laws, and Sabbath observance. While Antiochus was on a military campaign in Egypt in 168 BC, a group of Jews revolted against the high priest that Antiochus had appointed and took control of Jerusalem. Antiochus returned to Jerusalem and violently put down the rebellion, killing thousands of Jews and selling others into slavery. A year later, in 167 BC, Antiochus erected a statue of the Greek god Zeus in the Jerusalem temple. He also ordered that swine, biblically unclean animals, be offered on the temple altar, desecrating the holy place, fulfilling Daniel's prophecy. These acts were loathsome, abhorrent, and detestable to the Jewish people and were the first fulfillment of the abomination of desolation. The history of this tragic event in Jewish history and the Maccabean revolt it inspired are recorded in the non-canonical books of the Maccabees. These books give some useful history, though they aren't considered part of the inspired scripture. The first fulfillment we see of this abomination of desolation happens under the rule of Antiochus Epiphanes, when he offered this pig as a sacrifice on the altar outside the temple of God, and he placed this statue of the Greek god Zeus in the temple. Later in history, in AD 70, others consider this another fulfillment of the abomination of desolation, because Roman armies came upon Jerusalem under the leadership of a man named Titus, and they completely destroyed Jerusalem. They burned it to the ground, including the temple and the altar, thus ending the daily sacrifices. Kind of hard to offer daily sacrifices on an altar when it's completely burned to the ground. So we've considered this the second fulfillment of the abomination of desolation, the ending of the daily sacrifices, the destruction of the altar in the temple. And since that time, when the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70, it has not been rebuilt, and the daily sacrifices have not been restored. But Christ spoke about the abomination of desolation as a future event that will happen. That will be a sign to people who have the wisdom to recognize it, that a period of tribulation is about to begin. Exactly how it will be fulfilled in the future, we don't know. Historically, it was by both times stopping the daily sacrifices, first with the sacrifice of an unclean animal and putting this idol in the temple, second by the complete destruction of the temple and the altar. But we see here one obvious component of this fulfillment of the abomination of desolation. And all these descriptions of it in the book of Daniel, it talks about the daily sacrifices being ended, the daily sacrifices being taken away, which means they have to be started again. In order for them to be ended through an abomination of desolation, the daily sacrifices have to be restored. Something that the people of God have understood and been looking for decades now. Creates quite a challenge, though, because many observant Jews believe that these sacrifices can't just be restored anywhere. They need to be restored in the place where the altar was supposed to stand. The Temple Mount is currently under Palestinian control. Well, kind of. That's not 100% true. After the Six-Day War in 1967, Israel gained control of the Temple Mount. But in order to keep peace and not create another war, they gave the daily management of the Temple Mount to a Jordanian group called the Islamic Waqf. So this Islamic Waqf manages, controls the day-to-day operations on the Temple Mount. So it's a very obscure, very interesting situation there in Israel. It's under Israeli control, yet this group of Islamists from Jordan are the ones who control the Temple Mount. On that Temple Mount, many of you may know, stands the Dome of the Rock, the third holiest site in the religion of Islam. It sits on a place covering what's called the Foundation Stone. Muslims believe that this Foundation Stone is the very spot where Abraham attempted to sacrifice his own son. But, in the Islamic belief, that sacrifice was not of Isaac, but of Ishmael. You can see the confusion that Satan introduces into the world by having similar stories in different religions, right? Many Jews believe that this location of the Foundation Stone is not only this location that the Muslims believe is where Mount Moriah stood. The Jews would agree with that. But it is where Isaac was attempted to be sacrificed before God intervened. Muslims also say that it's the very spot where Muhammad ascended to heaven on a horse. I try to convince my girl that that's somehow proof that unicorns are evil. If it was a flying horse, it probably had a horn on its head, so unicorns are evil and they should be banished from our home. I never win that fight, but... But what's interesting to note here is that the location of the Dome of the Rock and the foundation stone that the Dome of the Rock sits over top of, the Temple Mount has been studied. It's still a debatable topic, but many believe that the location of the Dome of the Rock and the foundation stone is the very location where the Temple of God used to stand. That on that exact location where the Muslims have built the Dome of the Rock, that is precisely where the Holy of Holies once stood. And the Jews would like to see the restoration of the daily sacrifices and the rebuilding of the Temple of God believe that that altar needs to be placed exactly where God said it should be. So as you can see, this isn't something that's going to just work itself out casually. Some have come up with different ideas, different speculations. Perhaps maybe there will be some archaeological evidence that shows the temple actually was in a different place. Maybe that could happen. Maybe the altar will be set up somewhere else. Some have said, you know, World War III would be started if sacrifices were started in that very spot, because if the Dome of the Rock was destroyed and then the Jews started rebuilding the temple there, that wouldn't just be taken easily. Some have speculated perhaps it'll be some kind of peace-building effort. You keep the Dome of the Rock there, and we'll build the temple next to it. Who knows? But what we do know is that in order for the abomination of desolation to take place, the daily sacrifices need to be restarted. The question is a temple necessary for that? Is a temple required in order for the daily sacrifices to be restored? Look at the passage back here in Ezra chapter 3. Ezra chapter 3. As you know, this is not the first time in human history that the temple has been destroyed and that the people of God have been wanting to see a temple rebuilt. I use that term, people of God, perhaps too loosely. The Jews of today are the ones that want to see the temple rebuilt. We know that through the sacrifice of Christ, the sacrifice of animals, the temple is not necessary as part of our faith. But it is a prophetic indicator here of things to come in the future. This Temple Mount is such a contested place. Will it ever come to pass that the Jews can actually put the altar where it used to stand and rebuild the temple, so that these sacrifices can be restored? Up until about a year ago, Jews weren't allowed to do anything religious on the Temple Mount. They are allowed to visit the Temple Mount at certain times during the day, Sunday through Thursday, for about an hour and a half or maybe 2 hours in the morning and an hour in the afternoon. but under strict rules, that there was to be no religious practice happening on those visits to the Temple Mount. No prayer, no outward garb of religion, no prayer books, until a little over a year ago, when news reports started to come out of Israel saying that Jews had begun to pray on the Temple Mount, and the guards on the Temple Mount had just started looking the other way. They still are corrected and asked to leave if they were to prostrate themselves and bow down in some kind of obvious form of prayer. But they have been allowed in the last year or so to pray on the Temple Mount using their prayer books on a cell phone, standing, reciting prayers as long as they're not bending down, prostrating themselves. We see this kind of buildup that the Jews are pushing for the fact that they want to be able to exercise their religious rights in this holy place. Is the temple necessary? Ezra chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. And when the seventh month had come and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered together as one man to Jerusalem. This is after the time that they had been allowed to go back to the land of Judah to rebuild Jerusalem, to rebuild the temple. Verse 2, then Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and his brethren the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren, arose and built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. Though fear had come upon them because of the people of those countries, they set the altar on its bases, and they offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord, both morning and evening burnt offerings. They also kept the Feast of Tabernacles, as it is written, and offered the daily burnt offerings in the number required by ordinance for each day. Afterwards, they offered the regular burnt offerings and those for the new moons or new month, and for all the appointed feasts of the world of the Lord that were consecrated, and those of everyone who willingly offered a freewill offering to the Lord. And verse 6, from the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, although the foundation of the temple of the Lord had not been laid. If we look at history for a precedent, we just read one right there. Is it necessary for a new temple to be built on the Temple Mount in order for the daily sacrifices to begin? It wasn't here. Interesting things to think about. Troublesome things to think about. What kind of conflicts will come in the future that will lead to the setting up of these daily sacrifices? Or will it be something we even hear about? Christ said, when you see the abomination of desolation, then you'll know. But will we see? Will we even be told? Will it even be reported on if daily sacrifices were to start in some more casual way? In a way that didn't involve the destruction of the Dome of the Rock and rebuilding a temple? Interesting to think about, important to think about, I think, because, again, my point today for myself, just as much as for anyone else here in the room, is that we can never get to a point of feeling like, well, Christ can't return yet because we don't know how God will fulfill prophecy in the future. We don't know exactly everything that will take place and when these things will necessarily be fulfilled. Because sometimes prophecy is fulfilled in ways that people don't even realize in the moment. Our job, the purpose of thinking about what is to come before the return of Jesus Christ, is to motivate us to be ready regardless of when he comes. And even though what we're reviewing in this message that will continue next week is filled with troublesome descriptions of what's going to come on the world scene before the return of Christ, again, we need to keep it in the context of the fact that Jesus Christ is the one who is worthy to open the seals. The one who was slain to redeem us by his blood. The one who wants us to reign with him by his side as kings and priests on the earth. Is going to see us through whatever we have to endure before his return. Thank you.
And for Mr. Smith, for your message, for identity to take over him with some rise on last time. And for our final hymn this morning, we're singing hymn number 183, Crown Him with Many Crowns. And after that hymn, we'll call upon a local deacon, Mr. Pat Ingram, for the closing prayer. That's hymn number 183.